All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Stick a Fork in It. If you're not already following us on every social media, you probably should be, I would think. But since you're listening to this, I'm guessing you are. And we're here today for another fun episode.
Good to be back.
Let's go.
Yeah, exciting. Mm-hmm. We have a mediocre guest today, so I'm really excited about getting to that person soon.
So I think he's pretty great on my end, but I've known him for a long time.
Okay, well. Maybe you have a greater
frame of reference.
He won me
over.
So, you know, I'm flipping by the TV the other day. I still have the old cable version.
Wow.
Right. I like to have, I'm paying like $385 a month.
Worth it.
For the ongoing conversation in my house is, can we upgrade or update? My answer is no.
Yeah. Not allowed.
I know where all my channels are. I don't care how much I'm paying for them. I think I'm probably paying for the same station several times over.
Oh, for sure.
All of which I'm very comfortable with and happy about.
So it's an expense you're just fine with for your comfort.
Yes. Yeah. I'm flipping through, and Home Alone comes on.
Oh, nice.
Ooh, that's a classic.
Right? Mm-hmm. Talk about careers that went sideways.
Yeah.
Right? So, but it got me to thinking about homes, places that we live, places that we care about, things that matter to us in our homes. So I had a question for you two. Favorite place you've ever lived? Is there a home that you think, I loved it here?
I think the place I'm at now, actually.
Oh, that's so
good. Don't you live alone? Yeah.
Well, yes. Which is
the part you love about it?
It's
Which
really
says
great.
It all.
No
and
one
you should
else
try it.
Is there to bother me.
It could be anywhere. It could be a box.
One
it could
day.
By yourself.
One day, maybe.
Yeah.
So where you are now?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm at a house up in Wesley Chapel, and there's like a nice little pond behind it, and I've got like a little patio and a hammock, and it's very cozy.
Okay, you?
Wow. Okay.
Do you have a home that you grew up in, like one place you grew up in?
No. Yeah. Not really. My dad was an executive with U-Haul, so I lived all over the South as a kid. Which every once in a while when that Southern accent comes out, you could either pick Texas, Georgia, Louisiana, any of those. I'm going to have to say, though, when I've had my kids. So when I had my first son, I had this little rental house and on Donnelly Drive, and it's even my kids' favorite. My two older boys. It's a little bit off of Lake Keystone. It was this tiny little house. And I just think that's one of their perfect memories. And I think that's the most wholesome time that I've had in my life, living in that little house on Donnelly Drive that I rented. I couldn't afford to buy a home. But my kids talk about that all the time.
It's interesting that both of you chose a very simplistic, right? It's not an estate. It's like the comfort. And we often talk about the idea with food when we talk about what's your favorite meal. People generally cite either experience with those they love or, right, a particular time. Homes, right, or something about the place that you are and the connection that you have. I remember my very first apartment and decorating it. Right, so I had cinder blocks and then boards because those were my shelves.
Nice. Right? I think
remember
everybody's kind of done that.
Right, that whole, but it was mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember a friend, I didn't have this is when you still had telephones, units.
With a cord.
Right, with a cord. I could not afford a phone, but a friend gave me a phone that didn't ring.
Oh. You said yes.
I could make outgoing calls, which was for emergency purposes.
I was going to say it was just for the aesthetic.
It didn't ring. But occasionally I would just walk over and pick it up to see if somebody was calling. Never caught anybody calling.
Dang it. Yeah.
But I love that place. It was my own place. Homes matter, right? They're a critical part of who we are. And we've enjoyed, I hung a TV outside on the porch last week. First world opportunity, but now I can lay in the pool and watch TV.
Yeah.
Right?
We have that too.
Home.
That's
what home is all about.
Right.
Speaking of homes.
Yes. We have an amazing guest.
I
think he is.
We'll see. We'll check at the end of the podcast.
So he's our friend Mike Sutton from Habitat, which we'll get into. It's changed. I don't even know. Gulfside, Tampa Bay. We'll get there.
Favorite home you ever lived in?
Yeah.
You know, as you all are talking, I've been thinking about this. I feel like every home I've lived in has its own unique memory.
Yeah.
Appreciation
moments,
but I would say probably currently where I'm living right now is definitely my favorite, and I think it's just because family,
life, So what about that family? Yeah. Your life has changed dramatically.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. In a good way. In a great way.
In the most beautiful way. Yeah, tell us about it.
I've known both of you for a while. I think, I never thought I'd have
kids.
We
were surprised, yes. Raise your hand if you're surprised.
Yeah.
I think he was just as surprised as
I was
the
just
world
as surprised.
When we found out.
I never thought I'd have a child. I love kids, but I just never thought I would have one. And I think, Brooke probably thought the same. And, here we are. We have a 13-month-old now. Mm. So he's been the biggest blessing. So much fun. Totally changed perspectives and what we have found out just over the last few months is that we actually, as much as we have friends who are all have kids going off into college or mm-hmm. in college, we also have this group of friends that decided in their mid to late 40s that they were going to have kids too. So it's and actually
is that what you're telling people, mid to late 40s?
Yeah, that's what I tell them. We have Brooke was sharing with me an article that she recently read that actually there were more pregnancies in the 40s this past year than in the 20s.
Wow.
So there's been this big shift, which is kind of cool.
Wow.
Well, we've kind of can relate to the little ones, but Thomas and I are at a totally different level in our lives.
Yeah.
It's the grandbabes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a grandson who's 13.
You have a couple great grandkids too.
I have a 13-month-old.
You were talking about the phone. I was thinking about the old Lassie episode.
Oh,
what I find here internally is that none of my references work for any of my colleagues.
Yeah.
When I'll use a particular reference, they just blink.
Yeah.
Just
well,
look
wait,
at me.
I get it.
Sometimes.
Right.
There's just a little bit of a
there. I made a comment the other day in an email with about six employees where we had received a really nice donation, and I said, "Book it, Dano."
Oh.
And I realized I was the oldest person on the email chain, and then someone on my development team said, I had to look that up for reference.
Stop. Yeah. They revitalized that. They had
obviously it didn't reach. But anyway.
Wow.
I kind of relate, Thomas, a little bit.
Mm-hmm. When we have to explain ourselves, it's a little crazy. Yeah, so I have grandchildren. He has grandchildren. They're like a joy.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially because you can give them back when you're done.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'm telling you, I'm worn out, right? We're worn out by the end of it because we're not used to the day-to-day. It's something to chase after a 13-month-old.
Oh, he started walking at about 9 months and he never stopped. So he is high.
What's his personality?
High energy. He's high energy. He's always in stuff, wants to play with stuff. Although I have no idea what he's saying, he never stops talking. So he makes a lot of noises and looks at me. He does this now.
What's that? Which
is, where'd that come from?
No idea.
I love that.
But yeah, he's very impatient, wants what he wants when he wants it. And
maybe came by that honestly too.
I'm very calm and the calming.
Right.
Calming.
Your team's behind you. We're getting the truth by the looks on their faces right now. But
who brought them?
Yeah. It's interesting when your life gets so reoriented at the age that you're at, right?
Yeah.
That your priorities shift, the things that matter to you, the way in which you approach even how you carry yourself and what you think about and what are priorities.
I wouldn't change any of it though. Again, having friends who have kids in college and stuff now, I think the difference for me was I was able to establish my career. I was able to really figure out where I wanted to be, where I wanted to live, and all that. So, and I always joke, like I don't have to worry about buying a Pampers brand of diapers versus not being able to do that. And so been very, very blessed. And it also gives me a different perspective of the families we serve at Habitat.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'm sure, very similar to the families you all serve here at Feeding Tampa Bay. So it's been very eye-opening in so many ways.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Enlightening, life-changing.
Yeah.
And these things happen when they're supposed to, by the way. So this is where your life was God's supposed
plan.
To come.
Mm.
Absolutely. And I'm so excited for you.
Thank you.
I love, we're friends on all of our social and you see these gorgeous pictures of your family.
Yeah.
And I'm just really happy for you.
Thank you.
It's a great part of your life.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're also really good at your job.
I have a great team.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great team. Phenomenal team.
So does Thomas. So.
He does. Yeah.
Still tell us, okay, first of all, the last time you were here was January of, I got to look, January of 2021. So it's been a minute.
Yeah.
So
haven't been invited back since. So.
Well, we tried to get it together, but your schedule.
We had a gap in guests, so we just.
I know. Yeah. I heard. Cancellation. Let's call Mike up.
Yeah, let's get Mike in here. So tell us a little bit. First of all, tell us it's Habitat for Humanity, Tampa Bay, Gulfside.
Correct.
Which is the coastal counties.
Did you bring in an expert to help you with that one?
You know, to be honest with you, it was a disaster to go through the name change. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a parent organization with Habitat for Humanity International, and that whole process to go through a rebranding and a change was not an easy process.
We know what that's like.
Wow. Yeah, we kind of do.
Yeah.
We do a little bit.
Yeah. So it was not easy. You know, for us, we wanted to kind of reflect the growth we've had, the regional approach that we now have with serving three counties. Mm-hmm. You know, we went through a series of appeals for a name change, and this is what was kind of settled on. But we're happy with it now.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So for the listener or the viewer, mm-hmm. what counties?
Yep. So we serve Pinellas County, mm-hmm. The western half of Pasco. Mm-hmm. So from the...
West Pasco's a thing.
It is. Well,
when Pasco, you're in Pasco.
Honestly, Pasco should be two counties. Hmm. I've had conversations with commissioners about that. Either Pasco needs to be two counties, or they need to kind of have a little bit of a different approach, in my opinion, with how they approach it. Mm-hmm. So, because you have the east-west thing. Mm-hmm. And then we also serve now Hernando County, which has been phenomenal. Very welcoming. We've really enjoyed expanding.
A high-growth county.
Yes.
Yeah, well, both Pasco and Hernando, But Hernando's been very welcoming. We struggled in Pasco County mainly because of the divide, and having two Habitat affiliates there doesn't help that process. Yeah. But Hernando's been fun.
Well, you can always tell when a county's going to blow up when they have better roads than the city does. Like you're driving in the middle of nowhere in Hernando, and there's this gorgeous four-lane road with these beautiful bridges, and I'm like, okay, here we go, people. This is coming. So really briefly, tell us about the mission, how people get involved, and then we're going to jump off from there. We just want to remind folks what you guys do.
So Habitat for Humanity, international organization. We're in 70-plus countries around the world. We're in 1,000 markets or 1,000 communities across the United States. I always joke that if you've seen one Habitat affiliate, you've seen one Habitat affiliate.
Yeah.
So while we share the brand and the mission for the most part, each Habitat affiliate is its own organization. Our particular organization is 100% focused on new home construction. So we don't do rehabs. We don't do repairs. We no longer have restore operations. So in 2021, when we met, you know, we had three restores. Mm-hmm. We no longer have those. We've shut those down. And we're 100% focused on new home construction. Okay. So what we do is we partner with families who are looking for the opportunity to own their own home and that traditionally do not qualify for government assistance, but they also don't make enough to qualify for a traditional mortgage. And so we provide them a zero interest loan, mm-hmm. Zero down payment, that mortgage helps them to build generational wealth. Yeah. And it also, that zero interest keeps it affordable for them for the duration of the home loan.
Well, and you have amazing partners, Jeff Fishman, the Fishman family.
Oh, Jeff's great.
Yeah. So great, he kind of helps out with that.
Great friend and a great partner.
Yeah.
He does all of our title work too. His title company, Investors Title, does all of our title work and at a discounted rate, and it helps us significantly.
Yeah. He's such a good guy. They're such a great family. They make a huge difference in our community. Yeah. So you're celebrating some things.
Yeah.
Big stuff,
big
right?
Big year. Mm-hmm. Big year for us.
Big year. Yeah. So is it 40th anniversary for Habitat in your Habitat for Humanity
Correct.
Or overall for the organization? That's been around a lot longer, right?
Yeah. Well, the international organization next year will celebrate 50 years.
Okay, gotcha.
We are celebrating our 40th anniversary here in our community, which is exciting. Mm-hmm. A few short weeks, we will celebrate our 1,000th home, which is also a huge milestone. Mm. I started about 11 and a half years ago, and we were on home 280 when I started.
Wow. So, I was just going to ask you, where did you start?
Yeah, so we've had a lot of growth over the, you know, 11 plus years I've been at the affiliate. And it's really because we've built a phenomenal team, and our board is very much focused on growth. We've had 11 straight years of growth. Mm-hmm. I know you guys know what that's like. Mm-hmm. You build an organization that is focused on that, and that now it's the expectation, mm-hmm. right? So just like you, Thomas, I'm sure if you went to your board and said, hey, we're gonna go backwards this year, I'm sure you're probably met with a lot of stares and a lot of questions. And so we've been fortunate. We have a community that embraces our mission and embraces the work that we do, and, mm-hmm. and we've been able to do some good stuff. So 40th anniversary, 1,000th home. We're also something that's kind of cool is we filmed an episode of HGTV's 100 Day Dream Home. Mm. That will premiere on HGTV on September 30th. But we are actually doing a premiere at Ruth Eckert Hall on September 11th.
Ooh.
And it's a free event, open to the community. Hopefully you all can come. Thomas, we do need somebody to valet cars. So we'll put you to work out there. It's open to the community. We hope to fill up Ruth Eckert and have all of our friends and colleagues there to,
We would love that. I would love to go. We'd love to share it. Like, we could share that on social because we're partners, which we're going to talk more about in a minute.
Yeah.
I have a question because I have a favorite thing.
Yeah.
What is the most memorable? This is tough.
Yeah.
1,000 homes. Yeah. One of the most memorable home presentations or experiences you've had so far? Because I have one. I don't know if Thomas has one, but I have one.
Every home dedication that we do is unique in its own way. So every family has their own path and their own story on how they got to a place to own their own home. So I always try to be in the moment when we're doing a home dedication because that family is unique to the,
to the program.
So they all stand out in so many different ways. But, there's been a couple. I remember a woman who at her home dedication was talking about, you know, we always ask them to speak for 2 or 3 minutes. This woman, probably 15 minutes she went on. But she had such an awesome story. And she talked about how when she came into the program, she had no idea how to budget. And that was probably one of our biggest issues. And she had, I want to say it was like 57 cents in her account when she applied to the program.
Wow.
And she, a year later, was, again, low-income family, a year later, celebrating the completion of her home with $20,000 in the bank. Mm. All because she learned how to budget and she changed behaviors, right? And we often talk about at Habitat, we build homes. We're providing people the opportunity to own those. But we change behaviors through the education that they go through. And and for her, it really stuck. And that's something that always sticks out in my head, that story of 50 cents to $20,000.
And what's the memory that...
So this was on social. And I got to tell you, I got very emotional about it. You guys posted a video on social where someone who's been in your program for a number of years made her last mortgage payment.
Oh, yeah.
And I literally, I have chills thinking about it. How many people get the opportunity to own their home and live for many, many years to come?
Yeah.
And they started out low income. She learned how to budget. She now has this gorgeous home.
Yeah.
She's a testament to her family, to her community. Yeah. I just thought it was the most beautiful story in the moment that I was like, just wow. So to me, you guys made a complete change in her life and her family's life for the future.
So now that we've been around for 40 years, we're starting to experience those where folks are paying off their note.
Yeah.
And so we do a mortgage burning ceremony.
Yes.
And, and it's, I mean, it is. You can almost see kind of the relief when we light the paper on fire.
Yeah. It was the coolest thing I've ever seen. I thought it was amazing.
And to that point, we did have a family recently who we did a mortgage burning ceremony with. She paid her mortgage, 30-year mortgage off in 14 years. Okay. She made double payments every month for 14 years and was able to pay it off early. So,
which is amazing, which is something she learned. She was learning how to budget and take care of her family in the right way. Yeah. So the great part about having you on is we have been partners for a while working together.
Yeah.
Do you remember how that partnership came together?
Oh, gosh. No.
Really? Thomas, do you remember?
I do. I remember.
You do?
Yeah. We were out. We came out and volunteered.
Yeah.
At one of your homes, and you and I had a conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
And we talked about, hey, this might be, this is something we can add to it. So for the listener, Feeding Tampa Bay tries to outfit the house refrigerator with and pantries with enough food to get the family started. Yeah. Because I think, as you observed at the time, what you shared was, you know, we get them into the home, we, you know, provide a stable environment, all those things, but the pressure of life and income is still there.
Yep.
And so one of the things we thought we could do is figure out a way to ease some of that initial pressure when you're moving into a home and you need to buy new items and things of that nature. So that's how it started. I appreciate, Mike, that was a memorable moment to you.
So,
thank you for that.
I have a lot of memorable moments with you all. In fairness, that was in the middle of COVID, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was.
I spent 9 days in the ICU, and I don't remember
that was right after.
During that 1 year period.
Wasn't it right after?
It was right after that.
It was right before. Yeah. Oh, it was right before.
Was it right before that?
So the interesting part internally, this is why it's so memorable, is, Thomas gave you COVID. We were there volunteering, but we had the media there. So you fellows are talking and you announce this new partnership right there with the cameras going, and I come back and the person that was part of that program, because usually these things are thought about, planned, what have you. We walk in the building and the woman who ran the program says, well, I guess we're going to be providing food for Habitat for Humanity. Yeah. And everybody was excited, but that's kind of how that came about. And I'm like, yep, here's proof.
I do remember
part of an interview.
I do remember Thomas making the comment, now that some of this is coming back. I do remember him saying, oh, this is going to be a great program, and we'll figure out, the staff will figure out how to implement it.
That's what
the value
of
colleagues are. You know, I think I was listening to you talk about the mission, and a lot of what is on my mind recently is really about community.
Yeah.
You know, we at Feeding Tampa Bay often share that we hold a middle ground politically, because it's the right thing to do and the smart thing to do, and folks don't need us to opine on politics. But you and I live in a very different era today, in a very different community today. When you started 11 years ago, I started close to 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I first wanted to ask you how you think about that. And again, I want to set the question. How do you think about your work today versus how you thought about it 11 years ago? How do you navigate the waters you have to sail through to get a home built today versus 11 years ago? How have you kind of adjusted and adapted your business model? A whole lot in that, but I think you get the sense of the question.
So, you know, obviously the nonpartisan component, you know, as a nonprofit is important, but we are partisan when it comes to affordable housing, you know. You know, if we're willing to partner with whoever's willing to partner with us, things have shifted significantly. You know, the biggest challenge we've had, you know, over the last 11 years has been the increase in the cost of home.
Right.
When I started at Habitat, we could build a house for about $120,000. And now we're close to $300,000. And so you think about an 11-year time frame and how much that has increased. You know what has not increased is the affordability of the homeowners.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, wages have not kept up.
Right.
You know, we work twice as hard now to raise the money that we need in order to do the same amount of work, right? And so I do think that we've put a pretty significant emphasis on relationship building with our elected officials, with donors, with volunteers. We're in the relationship business. And I think we've just had to double down on, and part of that is the business model change. When I first started at Habitat, we did home repairs. We did home rehabs. You know, if somebody needed a new roof, we'd go and do a new roof. If somebody needed new windows, we'd go do new windows. And what we found was that while we were upgrading parts of people's homes, we were walking away feeling bad because we knew there was more that they needed. And that home was not, you know, you kind of start peeling the onion back and you're like, wow, this home needs a lot more than just a new roof.
Right.
We found that we don't fit that space well. And you know who does is Rebuilding Together. And so we've partnered with them significantly on referrals. And so we push all home repair inquiries to them. They push all new home inquiries to us, and it works pretty well. We also got out of the, you know, the retail business.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that.
I got some good stuff from there.
Yeah, everyone did. And when people give me a hard time about closing it, I said, you should have spent more money. So As you all know, right, we've seen a significant increase in insurance.
Yeah.
We've worked really hard to increase our livable or our minimum wage at Habitat to provide a livable wage to our employees. And so it's hard to make the numbers work. 11 and a half years ago when I started, you know, we had people making $7 an hour in our in our retail operation. You know, our minimum wage now is $21 an hour. And it's hard to make that work with donated couches and donated lumber and all that stuff. And so what we found was that we were running a very expensive operation in order to net, you know, a very small return. And so the risk associated with a restore was pretty significant as well. I used to get frustrated when I would walk into a Lowe's or a Home Depot and I need something off of a shelf and they had to close the aisle down and it became a big process to get that off of the shelf. Now I know why they do it, because of the amount of risk. And so we, you know, when you start having a countertop fall on somebody or, you know, just the risk associated with running a store, we looked at it and we just said, you know, this, we can go out and raise more money from folks and do more work and have less risk.
It's funny. It's important. The part that you're talking about, which I think is important, is a friend of mine said in the food banking world, said we were in an event together, so it's probably been 10 years ago. And she made a remark. She said, I don't want food banking to become the Blockbuster video of charities.
Yeah.
And the question she was asking at the time was, how do you evolve your mission?
Yeah.
What does that look like? You know, we think about evolving and adapting, and there's always a reticence to say, well, there's a different way for us to go about this. And in our world, we've gone the opposite direction, which is to expand mission pretty dramatically for the same reason you've talked about, you know, in some ways, which is, what is our core value, you know, to the folks that we serve? How do we understand that value and how do we live into that value? Which leads me to the next question. The core value that you offer to the community is what? Not the homeowner, the community.
The community? We're improving the community. I mean, at the end of the day, we are improving the housing stock. We are anchoring families in our community. That's probably the most important, you know, especially when you look at a county like Pinellas County, most densely populated county in the southeastern United States. We rely heavy on tourism, and people are being priced out of our community. They're moving.
Yeah.
I've lost a handful of staff in the last couple of years that can no longer afford to live here, and they've moved, right? So we're seeing it left and right. With Habitat, every time we build a home, we are anchoring that family in our community.
Right.
And it's one less teacher, it's one less police officer, it's one less hospitality worker that is now leaving our community because they have an affordable place to live, and it's... And nobody's going to jack up the rent on them next month.
Right.
You know, it's an interesting thing. I one of the laments that I have about our work is that oftentimes I was appearing before one of our county commissions not long ago and was in a defensive position with a particular commissioner, which is interesting to me upon reflection. Mm-hmm. Because an organization like ours economically will put close to $500 million in economic value back into the community.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Were we not here, what happens?
Yeah.
Right. In communities. One of the things I love that you do, I think you still do this, you show up at Pinellas County Commission with a big,
big check.
Big check showing them how much.
How much the property taxes. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I that's a very tangible way for us to show the community that, number one, these aren't free homes. The folks are paying a mortgage. They're paying property taxes. And those property taxes, in turn, are paying for the services we all rely on. And so, yeah, that check is kind of symbolic to the community. Like, you know, look at the contribution that these homeowners are making back in by paying taxes.
Well, and it's interesting. I think, you know, both you and I would talk about what the business focus of our organizations are, and we probably run them very similarly. For a long time, organizations like ours relied on the moral argument.
Yep.
You need to do this because being in a home is the right thing to do for another neighbor who does not have a home.
Mm-hmm.
For us, putting food on the table or other resources is the right thing to do from a moral perspective.
Yeah.
It's interesting in some ways that argument has less resonance for a whole bunch of different reasons.
Sure.
But what does have resonance, and I think one of the things that we admire about your organization, is the idea that we are improving communities.
Yeah.
That without us... right? Mm-hmm. The nonprofit world that is viewed as charity, which is a very different, you and I have used the same thing. Yep. A charity is a tax designation, not a business plan conversation,
yeah.
Right? So how do you look at, over the longer term, what your objectives as an organization is? Where do you want to go, mm-hmm. right? I don't know if you run out of real estate. I don't mm-hmm. know if you take over more. Sorry, that's not the word that we use. Merge is the word that we use.
Consolidate, collaborate.
There you go. Yeah.
Hostily acquire
yeah.
other affiliates. Like, yeah. But how do you think about growth in the future, and what does that look like for an organization like yours?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one I'm asked often. And I also have to somewhat tippy-toe around it, right?
Yeah.
I just, you know, speaking of podcasts, I just did one with the Business Journal, and I'm always asked.
Wait, what?
I'm always asked.
He was just on the Business Journal podcast?
You've had your turn, shush. Go ahead.
I just try to follow you, and I yes. watch what Thomas is doing. I'm like, I need to replicate that. You know, I'm often asked, you know, like, oh, what's next in terms of, you know, service area and that kind of thing. We've been very strategic in, you know, the Pasco consolidation, the acquisition of Hernando, because we feel strongly that the Tampa Bay MSA has a ton of confusion and overlap in the nonprofit sector. So we've been very intentional about the fact that we feel like we need one habitat. And there's a lot of confusion. And there's people live and work on both sides of the bay. They, you know, and you know, when you have multiple organizations doing the same work, it's like you guys, you serve what, 10 counties.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a feeding, whatever in 10 different counties, you'd have a lot of duplication of service. You'd have a lot of duplication of work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think for us, we do put our head down and we work really hard to serve those three communities we're in very specifically and very intentionally. But at the same time, we're always looking for opportunities, whether it's Habitat or other affordable housing providers. You know, we're always looking at like, how can we just get deeper and wider in the community? And along those lines, I get calls all the time from folks that say, I want to start a housing nonprofit.
Mm. Oh,
the first thing I say yeah. to them is don't.
We hear that a lot.
Right.
If you have the resources to get behind affordable housing, get behind an affordable housing organization that's doing the work and doing it well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Join us.
Part of the reason that all these municipalities and all these counties are having this, you know, DOGE conversation, number one is to deflect the need to really look at where government is spending money.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like, well, let's look at the nonprofits and where they're spending money. Let's get underneath their work, right?
Yes.
And, right. you know, it.
For which in our world, the government, quote unquote, is less than 1%, if even that, in terms mm-hmm. of the funding model, much like yours. We're a charitably based organization that is built by the community, for the community, by the community. You know, it's an interesting topic, and you know, I have discussed this before. The nonprofit sector is the only sector that perhaps can self-perpetuate when it shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you can have one funder that keeps a nonprofit open forever, and that ultimately ends up being a disservice to the overall capacity of the sector itself.
Sure,
but I think part of the reason why I asked the question is one of the things that struck me most was you've won several different opportunities to build multi-unit housing.
Yeah,
right. So my viewpoint of your work would always have been you found a little lot. You put a little, you know, 2,000 square foot home on it, you know, the family moves in, et cetera. You've really kind of said, no, we can do something different. We can focus. Yeah. And so in some ways, that's what I was thinking about is Habitat is not just about the one block house on a, you know, one little, right? It's a much different model, you see.
Yeah.
Because you bid on and won against competition, I assume.
Yeah.
Well, some fairly good contracts.
And part of that is because we do what we say we will do and we carry out our mission. We meet deadlines, and we've built a strong organization. we still love the infill model. We still love going in, just like you mentioned, find a lot, build a home, ends up being the nicest home on the block. They're 1,300 square feet homes. We're not building 2,000 square foot homes. Just, I want to correct you.
Yep, that. I appreciate
we're not building, you know, McMansions. Mm-hmm. Just so you know. I'm going to get a phone call after somebody watches this, right, and says, how do I get my 2,000 square foot home?
Our viewership is really low. I don't think people call. This isn't the Business Journal here.
Oh, okay. So, no, in all seriousness, though, we love that because we get to go in and we get to improve neighborhoods. However, in order to really do things at scale and right, really make a significant impact, and also, you know, I mentioned the cost thing earlier, you know, there is some efficiencies in being able to build multiple homes on a street or in a neighborhood. And so, and that really does change the fabric of neighborhoods. And where we're doing a lot of these multifamily developments right now are in communities where the rental percentage is through the roof. And so when you build a neighborhood like we're doing in Largo with 54 townhomes, mm-hmm, or in South St. Petersburg with between three subdivisions in a one block radius, it's 60 units, right? And you're dropping that many home ownership opportunities into a community, it changes the fabric of the
neighborhood. Well, and I think that's the thing that's exciting. So for all of us that do this work in any business, you kind of always think about growth and scope or scale. Mm-hmm. Scope meaning I'm going to do something different. Scale meaning I'm going to do more of it.
Yeah.
I really thought in some ways multifamily homes for you was a scope change. Maybe it's not. Maybe there are affiliates, mm-hmm, that do it. But I thought it was a really thoughtful way of saying we're going to apply a different lens to, yeah, what we consider success as.
Sure.
Our core value is, you know, success in a 1,300 square foot home on one lot in a community where it becomes, right, an anchor to that local community.
Yeah.
But the idea of multiple housing opportunities, because there's an awful lot of people, mm-hmm, both of you, well, in particular, you cited, right, homes that you lived in that weren't necessarily a single dwelling, mm-hmm, right? I mentioned the apartment I lived in. That was an important place to me.
Sure.
Right? The idea that you can figure out how to create volume and, mm-hmm, greater impact, which leads me to, I want to talk about your organization in a moment, but it leads me to the last question about, in general, mm-hmm, the housing market has had a ton of attention.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Tampa in particular, Tampa, sure, Bay in particular. Mm-hmm. When you look at different reports, as you said, the distance that people are driving has increased dramatically.
Yep.
Those that work in Hillsborough can't afford to live there. A wide variety. Pinellas, same thing. When you look at housing in general, if you're asked about the landscape, mm-hmm, of housing and particularly, mm-hmm, affordable housing, mm-hmm, what's your answer to better, worse, different, good, bad? Like, how do you think about that as a broader answer? We would say, to put context, mm-hmm, we would say economically families are struggling more than they ever have.
Yep.
Right? What's your view of the housing market and how should people think about it?
People are struggling more now than they ever have. People are home hopping. Apartment hopping at a record pace, right? Landlords are jacking rent up, and there's no. I don't believe necessarily in rent control, but I do think there needs to be some protection for renters. Mm. So, you know, if you're in a dwelling, you know, your landlord should only be able to increase your rent a certain percentage year over year. Throwing it up 100% to kick you out so they can get a new tenant in is not. It's not fair, right? So fair housing is extremely important. We have underbuilt as a region and as a state for so long, and we're never going to catch up at the rate that we're going.
So you used a pretty important word there. You don't think, you said never. You don't think we'll ever catch up. You don't
not
think,
at the rate we're going.
Okay.
Yeah. There's not a focus on affordable in the way that really moves the needle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've seen this massive influx of wealth that has come into Florida over the, mm-hmm, course of the last 5 years since, right, COVID hit. But what no one is talking about is the significant amount of folks that are leaving the state.
Yeah, that rate is increasing. Yeah.
And so, you know, and especially, you know, I keep mentioning in Pinellas, you know, we're 40% of our workforce is in hospitality or tourism.
Yeah.
And so what you end up having there is a lot of hourly employees who can, mm-hmm, no longer live here. And if people want to continue to live in a community that, you know, they're able to go out and eat in and they're able to belong to their country clubs and their yacht clubs, if we don't have the employee base to service that, it's going to quickly not be.
Do you think people listen to that argument when you make it? Like one of the things we tell
they
them.
They do, but they don't. So everyone wants affordable housing. Yeah. Anyone I have a conversation with will tell you, yeah, we need it.
Sounds
we need
great.
It.
Yeah.
We just bought a piece of property in St. Petersburg on the North Streets, right? So it's on, it's north of Central. And the amount of calls we've received about, well, we know you need housing, but that goes down in South St. Pete. Mm. There's just this automatic, you know, not in my backyard.
Yeah.
You know, people know we need housing, but, you know, you have counties that are putting moratoriums on affordable housing. Now they're doing it from a rental standpoint. We have, if there's been an area we've moved the needle on from an affordable housing standpoint, it's been rental, but we don't do rental. We do homeownership. Habitat's model is homeownership focused. And so, that has, you know, continues to be a struggle in, when you really limit the areas where we can build, it becomes even more of a challenge.
You know, the thing that we would say, particularly to, you know, our view of the world is that if you're going to have a healthy community, you have to have co-equal responsibility between, you know, electeds and appointed to create policy and enforce policy, that it's thoughtful and sensible. Mm-hmm. Corporations who make their profits here in our community have an obligation to, right?
Yep.
And then the nonprofit community has a role to play in making sure that the gaps that exist, we step into those. Okay. One of the concerns we have over the longer term is whether that balance, that equity is going to continue to be the same. And it doesn't look like it will be.
Yeah.
But in particular to corporations, we will say to them with some frequency, we're either feeding your customers or your colleagues or both. Yep. And that's not a good economic model for you.
Yeah.
Over the longer term, if consumer capability continues to slip or employee availability or productivity continue to reduce, that's going to hit you.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're trying to tell you is that's what's coming.
Yeah.
And it's a hard argument to make because there's no immediacy to it.
Yeah.
And that becomes a difficult conversation to say. In concept, everybody agrees with us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But when you hear the economic report that Bemetris Group does at the Tampa Bay Partnership every year, mm-hmm. and you see the data in there, you start to think, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Let's stop looking at the good stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's think about what's happening here with employee readiness or graduation rates or reading rates.
We just built 5 homes in Safety Harbor, and it took us 3 years to build 5 homes. The homes themselves took us 20 weeks to build, but it took us 3 years to get to the finish line because of the amount of pushback we got in the community.
Yeah.
And the amount of NIMBYism, you know, not in my backyard. What really changed the conversation was when, and we had promised this the whole time that we were going to recruit families from Safety Harbor, right, that were renting. But what really changed the conversation, and Morgan will tell you this, 3 out of the 5 were school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, you know, when I look at someone who's arguing with me that they don't want that kind of housing in their neighborhood, and I said, right. Well, if those people are good enough to take care of your kids, why are they not good enough to be your neighbor?
Right. Right. Yeah, it's so shocking that people
take that stance against things.
Oh, it's and it gets, I mean, we've had people show up to commission and council meetings in numerous municipalities, just argue till they're blue in the face. Because, you know, they're convinced that we're moving crime, drugs, prostitution into their neighborhoods.
Yeah. It's an amazing, you know, I've shared this story a couple of times, but it certainly has impacted me. We have pantries inside about 75 to 80 schools, mm-hmm. I think 15 or 20 in Pinellas County. But we took our board on a tour of, we have our own city bus now that we own. Literally.
Really? Yeah.
So we took our board on a bus tour of some of our program installations in different places.
Yeah.
And one of the places we stopped was one of our school pantries. And the representative from the school was doing a great job of outlining how the pantry has been helpful to families, how it's improved, you know, attendance rates,
sure.
health outcome, you know, just all the stuff you would expect. And then she finished with this. And she said, but also understand that 50% of the people using the pantry in the school are the teachers.
Mm.
Right.
It's eye-opening.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, what I said to our board on the way back and what I would say to all those that would listen to this, do we want to live in a community where the folks that are entrusted, as you just said, with the education of our children, the emotional well-being of our children, the rearing of our children, do we want to be in a community where those folks have to rely on a food bank or where you have to fight for their right to live in their own community?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are we doing here as a society?
Yeah.
If this is the argument in the conversation that we're having. Mm-hmm. That's a part of all of this. Just like you, mm-hmm. we put our head down. We're going to walk out of here, put our head down, push as hard as we can every mm-hmm. single day.
Yep.
But one of the things, because I am just a little bit older than you, I am becoming a bit more reflective about what's the greater thing going on here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the sense of judgment and condemnation of those that simply don't have the same opportunities we have.
Right. Yeah.
And you're fighting for their right to have them. We're fighting for the right to have them. And the outcome is a better community.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Not just from that first blush either. The way you're training folks, you're teaching them, you're building communities, mm-hmm. that's generational
yeah.
support, right? You think about what their kids are learning, what the neighbors are learning. I just don't understand the blinders that folks have on. That sure. It's just ridiculous.
I when I look at that kind of that teaching, the teacher population, and I know reflecting back when I was a little kid, I mean, I looked up to my teachers.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And I thought that they were changing the world just by the interactions I was, mm-hmm. you know, that they were having with me and fellow students, right? Again, we're losing a lot of teachers.
Yes.
Not only ones that can no longer afford to live here, but anytime we have an open position at Habitat, and I'm sure the same thing with you all, the amount of teachers applying for those jobs mm-hmm. blows my mind.
Yeah.
Because they want to leave. You know, look, if you got to fight for a 2% increase year over year, and you know, and you're not given any sort of stipend to decorate your room or you know, make sure you have supplies mm-hmm. for the kids, yeah. right? It's a tough profession to be in, and I give a lot of credit to folks who are. Yeah. You know, early elementary and all that stuff, going through schooling to become a teacher, because it's definitely not looked at the same way.
It's, you know, it's interesting. We say frequently, and I know it's a phrasing that you would agree with. We don't think there's a them. We think there's an us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the more that we can reorient our thinking around that. So you just said something a moment ago, and you referenced this a couple of different times. As I watch some of your social, apparently you've won every best organization in the history of mankind award at this point. Am I accurate there?
Yeah, there's a couple that, no, I'm, yeah. I, look, you get it, right? In the nonprofit sector, you, I know when I first started at Habitat, we got involved. We have a business mindset in terms of how we run things with a mission focus, right? Mm-hmm. And so, anytime we win an award, it's a reflection of the culture we've built at our organization. And it's also our way to continue to build our brand and awareness in the community, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm really proud of the fact that we have won some Best Places to Work awards mm-hmm. over the last couple of years. It really, it solidifies to me the work and the investment we've made to build a strong culture at our organization. And you know, it's also helped to put Habitat. I would argue that 11 and a half years ago, people knew what Habitat was and the communities we serve, but you know, there wasn't a ton of awareness of the work that we were doing.
They knew of your name, but not the effort that you put in.
Yeah,
right.
So
and I've seen the transformation that you all have had here at Feeding Tampa Bay. I did reference you at in front of 650 colleagues at the Nonprofit Leadership Center conference when I was on a panel and talked about the work that you guys are doing. I was very, and your team that was there applauded when I mentioned Feeding Tampa Bay, but I was very specific to say Thomas gets no credit.
Yes. And understandably so. So while we have an expert on the subject with us, I don't know if it's fair to ask you this in on the spot, but if you said, mm-hmm. look, there are three things mm-hmm. that I think are really the drivers of how I view culture in an organization.
Yeah, yeah.
Are there three? One, you just mentioned equitable pay.
Yeah.
Right? We think the same thing. Our lowest is $20 an hour, and we've worked hard to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll go over 200 employees here, and that's a sizable, that's like, how do you manage that? But and as well as our benefits programs and practices and all those different things. So one is, we think it's important that we represent the idea of, as you do, that that folks should be appropriately compensated for there. One of the things I love about folks will say, they'll talk about wages and CEOs and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's an interesting conversation to have with people about what the value of a good leader is and what the value of important, you know, the colleagues are. But so we'll say one of them is appropriate compensation. Yeah. What are the other things that you would say are critical to culture in your mind?
And one thing I will say about the compensation, I don't apologize for for that at all.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard it, especially in the Habitat Network, where people are like, you know, well, you know, we have a CEO that's willing to take less pay, you know, because they have a heart for the mission. And I don't apologize for paying our people and paying our people well. And you know, I also don't apologize for being compensated for what I, you know. So that's something that I, you know, I think is extremely important, that if we're charged with doing the work that we're doing in the community, we have to pay for the talent and pay for the amazing people that, you know, we work with, right? And so, and along those lines is the benefits, right? And I do feel like that's where we can get extremely competitive with the for-profit sector, is around benefits. And we've done that at Habitat. You know, I would say another key component is really leadership. You know, I know that I can't sit there and just talk the talk. I have to also walk the walk. I have to be an accessible CEO. I have to lead by example. And I expect the same from my leadership team and especially my exec team that reports to me. And I think Morgan would tell you that, that there's an expectation there and an accountability there for them as well. So, you know, and I really think the so again, pay, benefits, the leadership component. And you know, I would also say at the end of the day, it's really kind of given a voice to the employees. And this is something that I've really changed my mindset in over the years is, you know, listening to every employee. And, you know, we do stay interviews with all of our employees. So on their anniversary, we sit down with them and we talk to them about what keeps them at Habitat. And, you know, I read every one of those. Sometimes I dig into them a little bit more. Sometimes I have more conversations with their supervisor or that particular employee to make sure that we're meeting expectations and that we're providing a healthy place for people to work. I often talk about how divisive our community is. And I specifically look at demographics that, you know, are known to be underserved or you know, maybe a challenge to live in Florida currently. And I look at those demographics and I look at those employees. And then at the end of the day, I say, this is going to be a safe environment for them. You know, it's scary out there for the LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. It's scary out there for the African-American community. We've become even more divisive than I think we ever, or I ever thought we could be. But I want to make sure when they walk through the doors at Habitat that they know that they're in a safe environment and that they're protected, and we will support them. We just had a conversation with our staff about what's going on with ICE and, you know, some of this, you know, deportations and stuff. And we work in the construction field. We have a lot of people on our sites on a regular basis. And so the sad part was the fact that we even had to have this conversation, but I wanted to make sure our staff understood that we are 100% supportive of them and that if for some reason ICE showed up on one of our construction sites, what do we need to do and the steps we need to take? And so, you know, for me, it's providing a safe environment and people feel that in return.
If you cut every single member of your team open, what would be the common thing you would find inside each of them? What's the DNA that you all share?
I would say it's the passion and the desire to drive the mission forward.
Yeah, we often say that we have almost hired no one, maybe one or two over the years from food banking. We focus on character and culture.
Yeah.
Everything else you can teach.
100%.
Right, it's interesting. As you built out the model.
What's interesting about that, and you know, I'll throw out a little shout out to our friends at Living HR because I know you guys partner with Carrie as well and that team over there. I love the work that they've done with us, and they have been such a huge partner in us building our culture and getting us to the where we are, and people living out our culture code. If you look at the handful of nonprofits they work at, there is a or work with, there is a significant difference between those nonprofits and the rest of the nonprofit community.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. You know, and it's interesting. It's again, you go back to, I think we would share, you and I would share the idea as leaders of our organizations that it's morally the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also good business sense.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Retention matters. Mm-hmm. Productivity matters. Mm-hmm. Feeling, you know, all those things, the more that we look after our teammates to say, gee, do we all have the things that we need to have in place for you to feel comfortable as a colleague, right? We want to make sure those are mm-hmm. there because, again, we care about you as a human.
Yeah.
And it's interesting you talked about that idea. We've had a lot of conversation internally about the very concept that you're talking about, that it is tough out there.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked a lot, as you would, about workplace stress and what those things are. And mm-hmm. there's workplace stress here, right? Any organization mm-hmm. that pushes as hard as we do, there's, right, fair?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. Because the obligations and responsibilities we have are significant.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting how much people are bringing outside stress into work.
Yeah.
And they're conflating the two.
Yeah.
And they think that they're the same.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're often, right, it's really difficult to come from a circumstance where you're struggling with X, Y, and Z at home
mm-hmm.
and not leave that or be able to leave that at the door. It, invariably, it comes in with you.
Yeah.
And more, we're having the conversation of how do we help folks deal with that stress?
Yeah.
We hired an educator for the first time ever that's on our staff now, and part of her job is to help us build out training classes.
Okay.
Right? Because we're trying to help folks build a toolkit that they may not have in order to deal with life stress as much as any other, right?
An area that I feel like I've grown and evolved in is around this topic.
Yes.
Because I came from a mindset, and my first few bosses and the leaders that I kind of learned a lot from, you know, it was definitely an environment where you get to that door and you leave that out there, right?
Yeah.
You know, you leave your crap at the door. You're here at work, you focus on work. And I've had to, and it's been a struggle for me over the years to really get to a place where I understand we have a couple of folks that are dealing with some pretty significant issues. So again, talking about our employee base, an area we've invested in has been, I mean, we've gone out, you know, we have our standard EAP program, but we've invested a bunch of money to make that so sweet for the employees
mm-hmm.
and their families, right? So to ensure that people have the access to help and access to support. And, you know, we've had some folks that have had to take, you know, a leave here or there. We have one employee who recently, you know, her parents, unfortunately, are getting deported. They were given a certain amount of time to get out of the country. And so we told her, don't you worry about your job. It'll be here when you get back. Mm. Go be with them. Check in. And we're here to support you. You know, the mic of probably 15 years ago probably would have been like, well, it sounds like you're gonna have to move up there. We're gonna have to fill your role, you know?
How much do you think your battle with COVID affected you in understanding these things?
Becoming the softer, gentler Mike? I don't know that it was COVID as much as it's been an intentional effort. I mean, coaching, you know, I've had a coach, two coaches actually, can never get enough.
The first
coaching.
One quit.
Yeah, she just ran away. I have one coach that I check in with. That was my regular coach for a long time that I check in with probably on an annual or semi-annual basis. And it's kind of more from a reality, you know, kind of gut check. And then I have an ongoing coach that, you know, I do a lot with. I think a lot of it's just, you know, maturing, emotional intelligence. I do a ton of reading on that because something clicked with me, and it was before COVID, but something clicked with me that, man, I gotta, you know, I can be tough and I can and drive, you know, the organization and have high expectations, but I often also have to be soft and gentle with folks and meet them where they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think COVID played a part of that, and definitely Cole has in the last year, people will tell you that maybe not at work, but I've had a lot of people that are like, man, that's the best thing that's ever happened to you. You're like a teddy bear now. So, you know, life experience, right?
I don't think your crew's agreeing. Your crew is not agreeing.
No, you don't think so? Sure.
You go with that. You go
with
that.
It's a long drive back to the office, Morgan. No, I mean, you know, we all have to evolve. Yes. We all have to continue to learn and reflect. Emotional intelligence is something when that first, you know, it's like, like, what is this stuff? But it's important.
You know, I think you now know this as a dad. You know, it's interesting if you think a lot, if you start to think a lot about the word legacy. Mm-hmm. You know, someone might say your legacy is 1,000 or whatever the number gets to when you retire, homes in the community. Somebody might say my legacy is this building, and I don't feel that way at all.
Yeah.
I have no interest in that being my legacy. None
People
at all.
Want that to be your legacy because I hear that all the time.
Yeah, and I have no interest in that at all. The legacy that's important to me are the folks that I worked here with and where they go and what they do.
Sure.
Yeah. Like you'll feel about your kid.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't work as closely with that, but I can say for Shannon, she would probably tell you that I've been influential in her career.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes. That I've, you know, entered into her world to say, hey, look, you can do more, be more, have more,
mm-hmm.
you know, grow into a role and opportunity that you may not have known.
Mm-hmm.
To me, you know, same thing I feel about my kid and now my grandkid. Our legacy ultimately will be the people that we've raised
for sure
in our respective businesses.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I think, you know, hearing you talk about that, there's obviously from my perspective, whatever that distance is, there's an incredible correlation between your evolution as a leader and your success in your organization.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it took me a while to get there. I often look back to my CEO when I was at Big Brothers Big Sisters, Susan Ralston, and she was the toughest leader I've ever worked for. She expected a lot. Her and I would butt heads a lot behind closed doors, but when we walked out, we were always in step with each other. But I often look back, and her and I have talked about this, when we look at our leadership team when I left there, I know for her, one of her biggest legacies is the fact that I've gone on to run Habitat and pretty successfully because of our team and the community. One of our other So there were four of us on this team. One of the others has gone on to serve in an executive leadership role at Big Brothers Big Sisters of America, and she's been there for a long time. And then the other one has gone on to lead a successful career in a CFO role. Mm-hmm. So I know for her, she's able to look back and she looks at the three of us, you know, in that way where it's like, okay, that's my legacy. I was able to take three folks who, you know, were probably in their early 30s at the time and help guide their careers to a place where they're successful. Yeah. And I look at that for sure. I look around my exec team and I'm constantly like, you know, how do I keep them? How do I grow them? How do I make sure they don't want to leave? But even when we have folks that have left the organization, when I see someone that gets recruited away, I don't take that personal. And I know there's a lot of leaders out there that get pissed off or they get upset when someone leaves them. I look at it like it's a compliment to what we've been able to do, that they've been able to
help them
to
grow.
Go off and
yeah.
And maybe, you know, maybe it wasn't the right fit at Habitat, or maybe we didn't have that promotion opportunity for them right then and there. And so I think that's a reflection on the leadership there. So
from my perspective, it's been a pleasure to watch the maturation of your organization, the success of your organization, you as a leader. It's, it is said often of politics that we have dumbed down the position so much that nobody that's worth anything wants to become a politician. Forgive me for wherever this ends up. And so it's not a personalized statement towards any person. It's a broad generalization. But I worry about and want to make sure, you know, Tim Marks is retiring.
Sure.
Beth Houghton just left JWB. You know, these are all leaders in our community that have added value. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned that the generation behind us has the opportunity, and I think we have an obligation to make sure that that opportunity for leadership continues. Because as we said at the start of this, whatever folks think of the word charity, it's not a word in our vocabulary.
Yeah,
what we think about our world is community impact.
Yeah.
And we have to continue to drive community impact. And I would just say from my perspective, it's been a joy to watch you over these last few years that we've been in the same community doing the same things.
I appreciate you saying that. I think, you know, a driving factor behind our success has been that we've surrounded ourselves with organizations like Feeding Tampa Bay, You know, and I think I said this when they had no one to say anything nice about you for the Business Journal, most admired CEOs.
Yeah.
And so they were like, Mike, will you say a few words on camera? And I'm like, yeah, if you can edit something together that sounds decent. But, you know, one of the things I've said is that in a very indirect way, I mean, we catch up, mm-hmm. you know, as much as we can. But, you know, it's not like we're meeting on a monthly mm-hmm. or even a weekly basis. But I look at you as a mentor because of what you've been able to do here and grow this organization. And I often, you know, joke that there's CEOs out there in the community that I say, gosh, we want to be like them. And then there's CEOs that I'm like, we don't want to be like them.
Yeah, this is ripe with posers.
Yeah.
Our industry 100%. Is ripe with posers. But that'll be another episode. We'll just cover who we think are posers.
There you go. Right.
So if you're a listener, tune in for that. That one will be fun. We're going to name names.
Can we name names for that one?
We'll see how that shakes out at the end.
Right. There you go.
We are so thrilled to have you back again. I'm
Thanks
sure this isn't
me.
Gonna be your, you're coming back for posers.
Yeah,
posers.
But, you know, we kind of close out the show mm-hmm. typically that we ask this question. We asked you, I believe, when you were here in 2021, and it's gonna be interesting to make a comparison on how this might change because mm-hmm. your life has changed so much.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to have dinner with four people.
Ooh.
You're adding three people to the table.
Yeah.
The first question is, now that could be somebody that's has passed on.
Passed on.
It could be somebody you look up to. It could be anyone.
Yeah.
You bring these three people to the table. The first question is, who are they?
Who did I say in 2021? Do you have that?
We do have it.
Do you know who I said? Mm-hmm. I'm just curious who I would have said.
I think you said me.
Thomas,
that was wonderful.
Right. Yeah. Are you serving the dinner?
Well, I was going to say, what are you cooking and who's serving? And that you could add that in.
So three people.
Three people that you're adding to the table.
Okay.
My favorite still, to give you a moment to think, is my parents and Babe Ruth. one of our guests, my parents and Babe Ruth.
Yeah. So I would throw my mom in there, you know, Brooke Cole, but I have the blessing to have dinner with them often. So I'm going to leave them out, but I wanted to say that just so that they don't, if they watch this, they don't say, well, what about us?
Yeah.
But I would, this one would probably surprise people, but I would say George W. Bush is one.
Okay.
Not because of politics.
George H.W. or George W.?
W.
Okay. That owned the Rangers.
The younger one. Okay. And the reason I say that is because of his leadership through 9/11 when that happened. And mm-hmm. A big moment in my life is when he was standing on the rocks with the megaphone. And I always remember his poise of having to get on TV that night and to address the nation. And I would just love to pick his brain about all that.
Yeah.
And I always thought, like, again, removing politics, a lot of people thought he was a horrible president. Unfortunately, he's an alcoholic, but I always thought he'd be a fun person to have a beer with.
Yes.
You know, so
you
he's
get him a non-alcoholic beer.
Non-alcoholic. Yeah. There's so many of those now.
There's.
So I would say him. I don't know why I'm going politics, but I would also say Jimmy Carter.
I was hoping you were going to say that.
I would love to talk to him specifically around, you know, his engagement post-presidency with Habitat and I had the blessing to have lunch with him, but it was in a big setting with about 30 people. So I didn't have the one-on-one time.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say him. And then I would say probably a third person. I was asked this question one time, and the three people I did throw out were Jimmy Carter, JFK, and Tupac.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be a kind of a fun group to have a conversation with. I think the third that third person would probably be MLK.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, someone who during his time living was admired by so many,
mm-hmm.
yet hated by so many.
Right.
And just how he navigated all of that. I would love to pick his brain as well. So. Mm.
Wow, that would be amazing conversations around that table. I love George W.'s art.
Oh, yeah.
He is an incredible artist.
He's just so, like, there's just so much about him that I, like, his whole thing of, like, you know, sitting at a funeral eating gummy bears and, You know, yeah. his relationship that he has with Michelle Obama is just so like playful and stuff. Like, there's just so much about him that
intrigued.
I'm very intrigued by it. The art is definitely one of them. So,
and this goes about what your favorite foods are. What are you serving at the table?
I'm a very simple person. So we do a lot of factory meals at home. So I'm going to cook up a couple factory meals.
There you go.
They may be disappointed.
Someone else can cook.
Yeah, somebody else can. You can order in.
Someone else
can cook.
So my go-to if I go out to a nice meal is typically, you know, like a butterfly filet. Like I love a good steak. Council Oak has probably the best steak I've ever had. But I'm also kind of like a hamburger dude. You know, I love a good solid, you know, New York style slice of pizza. You know, I'm not going healthy.
Yeah.
You know,
it's your dinner.
So, yeah. So
it's your dinner.
Nice.
Well, my thing,
I feel so very judged by Thomas whenever I speak. Whenever I speak, I always feel judged.
What's your favorite burger spot?
It depends. Probably Five Guys.
Five Guys.
You like Five Guys?
Yeah, I do. So
what about El Cap over in St. Pete?
I've been there a long time ago. I haven't been recently.
Oh, we should go.
Yeah,
you can buy.
There you go.
So there's the challenge with burgers is you just can't overeat. Just don't. They're good on their own. When they start putting all that kind of crap on them.
That's why El Cap's awesome.
Yeah. It's really about the quality of the beef.
Yeah.
It's like coffee. A good cup of coffee should be strong and black.
Yeah.
Everything else is dessert. Right. Once you start putting all this other stuff on the burger, you're really hiding poor quality meat. That's really what you're doing.
There's nothing better than a burger, you know, a mom burger, you know, like one that she makes and throws on the grill.
Yeah.
You know, all this fancy stuff. I agree. The fancy stuff of
simple.
You know, it's like a burger that's this high.
Can't even eat it.
Like, onion rings and donuts and like, you know, stop.
Yeah.
Is your burger's that bad that you got to hide it?
That's
with
exactly
a
right.
It's 5% of the whole sandwich.
You're hiding something.
Right. People don't really like coffee. They like the dessert of all that's in the coffee.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate a cup of dessert every morning. Just one.
Yeah. Right.
Just one. I cannot imagine.
We stopped at
black.
Starbucks on the way over, and Morgan ordered something that, I mean, it looks more like a vanilla shake than it does.
Delicious.
Yes. But we tell ourselves it's a coffee.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Okay.
It had vanilla. It had oatmeal. Yes. I don't know what it
She's
had
behind
in it,
you going lies.
No, all of them.
Well, Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks for having
thank
me.
You.
This was so much fun.
Thank you.
Always love
hanging
out with you.
Congratulations on so many things. Mm-hmm. 40th year, 1,000 homes. Wow. And where did you start?
280.
280, and you've hit 1,000 in your time.
Yeah.
And then we're all going. We're going to the HGTV premiere.
Yeah.
Make sure we have the information.
Yeah. We'll get you good seats.
Yes.
I've learned some things from you. I really love it, and I know our listeners are going to appreciate it. So thank you, my friend.
I appreciate you all. Thank you for everything you do.
Of course.
You too.
And on the note about learning, I'm curious, like what jumps to mind that like was the biggest thing you feel like you learned today? You really want the listeners to take away from like today's episode?
Shannon's looking at me, so I think that means she wants me to go first.
Well, I would say around the camera.
She's gonna think because she didn't learn anything.
No, I
just said that.
I wrote my notes down. You want me to go first? Because you may steal them.
Oh
no, you looked over here, so I'm going. What is always the result of the how?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think what Mike said in so many different ways throughout the conversation today was that once he figured out the how, the what came behind it, right? And I think good leadership, but also good organizations are always built from the inside out. We're joking about the idea that there are pretenders in our space. There are pretenders in our space, and they tend to build from the outside in, meaning they focus more on the kind of accomplishment and, hey, look at us, as opposed to building solidly from the inside so that, right? And I just am always taken by leadership like that and the organizations that I tend to most admire, no matter where they are. You know, whether you're Apple or whoever that has said we're going to make sure that we make the best products available so the consumers love them. It's the same thing in our world. And what Mike said over and over again, which I loved, was we have a particular way of doing things that is true to who we are and what we believe. And as the result of that, we've built more homes in the last X years than any affiliate in the United States. And I think that's what will stay with me.
So I wrote down a number of things, actually. Something that resonates and that I think people should understand is we are businesses with a mission.
Mm-hmm.
right? You've got to be able to have the right team and, you know, all the things that are so important to a successful business. And that's why both organizations have done really, really well.
Yeah.
And that includes culture and everything else that has been invested in. I've known about your work for such a long time and known about the communities that you've built, mm-hmm. but it's the community influence, thinking about that generational mm-hmm. opportunity you are blessing these counties with by what you're doing, because those children are learning and their children will learn. And that finally, we all need somebody to care. Mm-hmm. Whether it's you're caring for these families and giving them the strength to stand on their own and holding their hands through it, making sure they understand how to do it. Mm-hmm. But also when you're at a job, like Thomas mentioned, having someone care mm-hmm. about your growth, care about your thoughts, care about what you're doing, care about your culture, but also everyone that we touch. We care about them.
For sure.
You know, we talk about school pantries. Right now it's almost back, school just started.
Yeah.
So making sure, like, things change when you care about your friends, your community, mm-hmm. and anyone that comes along your path. There is never a bad neighborhood.
Yeah.
So, there's no such thing.
There's no such thing as a bad neighborhood.
What did you learn, dear producer Ev?
So one thing that I was and wasn't surprised to hear was when you were talking about the NIMBYism, like the not in my backyard, if people aren't familiar with that. Like, I think that there's this desire to help people and make things better.
Yeah.
But then when you're doing it, people are like, not like that, not over here, don't do that. And it's like, what are you talking about? Yeah. So I feel like that's something to people to really pay a lot of attention to.
Sure.
I learned that at Trinity Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Don't need to say anymore. Yes. Just Google it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you guys, another episode wrapped. It's always good to have good friends around the table.
Mm-hmm. This was fun.
Yeah. Good to see you again, friend.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you.